Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. I'm Sharon Grant, your host for today, May 16th, 2022. This morning, our guests are Mole Bill Resnick, who speaks with John Pfeffer, editor of Foreign Policy Focus. They discuss this emerging world of economic and military conflict and what possible outcomes may emerge. Then, Mole Jan Hawkins speaks with youth organizers about the importance of the Portland climate strike, scheduled this year on Friday, May 20th. And finally, we will conclude with Mole Joe Clement and Emily Dobrinsky, who continue their discussion from last week on why libraries should be champions of democracy in the workplace. But first, this is KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio in Portland and beyond. We are in our spring membership drive for 2022. Community Radio is called that because it is supported by our listening community in Portland and everywhere KBOO can be heard. Through May 20th, every listener has the opportunity to support KBOO during our membership drive. KBOO is a nonprofit organization with 80% of our funding coming from our members. You can easily support the station from wherever you are by one of four different ways. You can text to kboo.fm/give. You can click donate in the mobile app. You could text KBOO to 44-321. Or you can mail to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Either way you choose, we thank you. Next, Bill Resnick talks to John Pfeffer, the editor of Foreign Policy and Focus. They discuss the emerging world of economic and military conflict. Bill?
Hello, John Pfeffer. Welcome to KBOO here in Portland, Oregon.
Thanks for having me on the show.
John Pfeffer directs the webzine Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's written a great deal on Eastern Europe, Russia, the Far East. His book, Aftershock, A Journey into Eastern Europe's Broken Dreams, examines how the years of free market reforms have failed to deliver prosperity, indeed delivered corruption and organized crime. Last week, we discussed the Ukraine, its terrible costs in lives now, and its future costs that will be felt across the planet as food shortages drive up the price of grain, this ultimately leading to malnutrition, hunger, and famine in many countries. We also discussed that as humanity makes war in Ukraine, it wastes resources and distracts attention from solving humanity's preeminent crisis, that of global warming. So, John Pfeffer, after World War II, the U.S. and top of the world, with all the power countries of the pre-war world ruined and desperate, the U.S. embarked on a program of rebuilding that world, but in ways such that the U.S. remained the sole great power on the planet, with, of course, the Western white powers on top and the colored South providing their resources. The U.S. first concentrated on Europe and the unexpected victory of the Ukraine very recently in defeating the Russian invasion, a story that has to be told another time. The U.S. achieved unchallenged dominance in the whole European world. But Asia might write a different story because since the 1949 victory of the Chinese Communist Revolution, the U.S. has sought to contain China. But was never able to destabilize China or defeat it in proxy wars in Korea and Vietnam. And then the U.S. decided to give it access to U.S. markets as long as it allowed U.S. firms to operate. Thus aided by U.S. and European companies who wanted to exploit the huge supply of disciplined workers, disciplined by the authoritarian Communist Party and Army, China developed into a manufacturing colossus. But China refused to accept U.S. domination. In fact, China has established a rival world trade, finance, banking, and investment system. It competes with the U.S. And through loans and grants, China has attracted business from the whole global South. So instead of accepting U.S. military dominance, it has developed nuclear weapons and a large disciplined military force capable of projecting Chinese power into all of Asia, especially the South China Sea, where both Chinese and U.S. warships are shadowing each other and showing the flag. Finally, China and the U.S. are also competing in space, with China unwilling to allow the U.S. to dominate the heavens and place space weapons. Now, China is as authoritarian as Russia and as imperialist as the United States. It's seeking world domination. The Russians failed. So as to the near future, China is the only force opposing the consolidation of a U.S.-dominated world. That struggle could go in several directions. It could have disastrous outcomes, or maybe a good one, if the U.S. and China rise to the occasion and come to collaborate to stop global warming. And there are many others and many other outcomes, partly depending on how the U.S. left organizes. So, John Pfeffer, tell us about the hopefully not deadly U.S.-China dance.
Well, I think the attempt by the United States to kind of maintain its unipolar advantage, which it had at the end of the Cold War with the collapse of the Soviet Union, is longstanding. The change in the last decade or so has been the challenge that China presents to that particular unipolar power. China has not only built up its military, not to the extent of what the U.S. has in terms of military capabilities, but significant nonetheless, and certainly enough to present a kind of hegemonic security presence in the region, including the South China Sea and certainly across the Taiwan Strait and elsewhere. But in addition to its military spending, of course, China has built up its economy to be either the number one or number two economy in the world, depending on how you measure things. Part of that strategy has been to lift all boats simultaneously. In other words, for Chinese economic growth to be maintained at relatively high levels, China has determined that it needs to kind of raise the economies of its neighbors and even more far-flung regions so that those areas can both absorb Chinese capital for infrastructure development, but also buy Chinese products. Not a dissimilar strategy from what the United States did in its own economic rise with respect to Latin America and other regions of the world. So the United States and China, of course, have come into rather direct confrontation. The Obama administration had decided that the United States is wasting an enormous amount of military dollars as well as economic dollars in the Middle East. The United States poured money into, of course, Afghanistan and Iraq, the wars there, but also into maintaining U.S. military presence in the region. The Obama administration decided, not unwisely, to shift U.S. attention away from the Middle East and toward East Asia. That wasn't only to kind of confront China or to contain China. It was also to take advantage of what is an extraordinarily wealthy part of the world. China has basically become the leading trading partner for all of the countries of the region. The United States was losing out on trade, losing out on investment, etc. So this was both a military and an economic decision. The war in Ukraine has been somewhat of a complication in the sense that the United States had really decided that it wanted to draw down its military presence in Europe as part of a larger drawdown of military presence from the Middle East and shift those resources to Asia. But Russia's invasion has sent a different signal that, as far as the Pentagon is concerned, it therefore has to not only maintain current U.S. force posture in Europe, but potentially expand it as well. The other complication, of course, is, as you said, Russia and China have a very close relationship, a relationship that is based on some military cooperation, though not an extensive amount, but mostly economic. Russia has been part of this Belt and Road Initiative. China has poured money into especially energy infrastructure within Russia, which is part of a kind of longer-term reorientation of Russia's energy infrastructure away from supplying Europe and towards supplying Asia. Even before Russia invaded Ukraine, Russia saw the writing on the wall. I mean, Europe was determined to reduce its carbon footprint, which meant that it was going to be cutting over time its imports of Russian fossil fuels. So even before this invasion and the ban that the EU has pushed through, Russia understood that it would have to find different markets for its primary exports. Russia's primary exports are fossil fuels. So what we've seen so far in terms of kind of the post-invasion repercussions in terms of Russia-China relationship, China has not been happy about the invasion. It's never happy to see the sovereign countries like Ukraine, the sovereignty of those countries violated. It is a big champion of sovereignty, at least of countries that it deems to be sovereign. Obviously, Taiwan does not fall into that category. And it was not happy to see disruptions of the global economy because disruptions of the global economy necessarily impact Chinese growth forecasts. What China has done has been to condemn the invasion, effectively, to buy some Russian products, fossil fuels, etc., because China has an almost inexhaustible need for energy these days, not so much produced domestically, coal, for instance, and more dependent on imports, but so far has not provided Russia with any military assistance. And that's kind of the key red line that the United States has established in its kind of negotiations with Beijing. So right now, you know, we're seeing a kind of reorientation geopolitically that is isolating Russia. Even as I said, you know, the majority of the world has not signed on to the sanctions against Russia. But nevertheless, the most significant of Russia's partners are basically avoiding any kind of economic engagement with the country. So this isolation of Russia is very significant. But ultimately, what I think it will do is remove Russia from any kind of geopolitical influence and focus attention more squarely, as it was increasingly, on the U.S.-China relationship. And this could be an opportunity for the United States and China to effect some kind of modest rapprochement, or it could be renewal of the kind of tensions we saw very sharply during the Trump years.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Live stream 24/7, 365 to the universe. And remember, the variety in the Old Mole is the variety of democratic struggles from below that we cover. I'm talking to John Pfeffer, the director of the webzine Foreign Policy in Focus. He's written a great deal, articles, books, does interviews. Today, we discussed the build-out of China's economic strength. Today, we are discussing the build-out of China's economic strength, how it has reached the capacity to challenge the U.S. across many fronts. My sense is China's U.S. rivalry grow more tense if the U.S. continues to control the skies and outer space, the man claims the right to put weapons in space, and if it continues to command control of world trade, finance, and banking transaction systems, with its companies getting all the business and profits for managing the service. What's your expectations on these issues in the future of the U.S.-China dance?
Well, China has already established its own kind of independent institutions when it comes to international finance. It's established its version of the IMF, established its version of the World Bank. These are not exclusive organizations. In fact, European countries are members of these institutions, but the United States in particular has stayed away. China's strategy has been twofold. I mean, one, it competes with the United States within international institutions as a kind of major capitalist power. And the second is that it is preparing for a more China-centric international system. As I'm sure many of your listeners know, that, you know, voting rights within the IMF and the World Bank still are heavily weighted in favor of the United States, and China does not have kind of a proportionate amount of power given the size of its economy or the size of its population. So that's the kind of major reason why China has, you know, established these independent institutions. It wants to write the rules of the game, much as the way the United States wrote the rules of the game that enabled it to maintain kind of global economic power for the better part of the last 75 years. Whether that will change, the United States may aspire to have unipolar control, but it certainly no longer has the means to establish that control. And it has a choice. The United States can either cooperate with other countries in a kind of restructuring of the global economy in this kind of climate crisis that we all face, or it can continue to try to assert its power and continue to maintain control over the writing of the rules. And unfortunately, you know, certainly during the Trump era, we saw a kind of heightened effort to resurrect U.S. unilateralism, a return in some sense to a liberal internationalism under Biden, which, you know, includes some greater degree of engagement with multilateral institutions, though, of course, still a kind of continued effort to maintain U.S. hegemony. That struggle between kind of the internationalists, who still unfortunately don't have much power here in the United States, and the hegemonists, who basically represent the foreign policy elite, I think that will continue. And it will, you know, we'll see an effort by, you know, unilateralists in the form of Trump or some of his allies try to kind of come back to power in 2024. I don't at this point think they'll be successful, but it really will be a battle within the liberal internationalist camp about how to address, how to kind of restructure U.S. power in this era of resource depletion and Chinese economic strength. And again, either the United States will take a kind of short-sighted and aggressive approach that privileges kind of U.S. policies, U.S. laws, U.S. population, or it will adopt a more engagement-friendly approach in which it works with other powers to design, a different international system. You know, to a certain extent, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is bringing us even closer to that moment where we have to redesign these institutions. Obviously, the UN is not very effective in either preventing war or dealing with the war that's currently ongoing in Ukraine. Our institutions dealing with climate crisis, obviously not up to the task, since we are not, you know, we have a number of pledges that were made as part of the Paris Agreement, but we have not seen anything close to the implementation necessary to meet any of those goals. So this redesign, this international redesign, is urgently needed. But whether the United States, in good faith, engages in that process, that's really a tough question.
Yeah. I think I'm going to conclude with the observation, with enough time, my guess is that it would ultimately, unless something, some really irrational person takes power in the United States, and who knows what the many forces of total destruction are at her or his fingertips, or they. But climate change is not going to wait, and I think this is unless the U.S. and China get together and do something major in the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, the risk of mass extinctions grows and could include Homo sapiens. Anyway, that's an alarmist view, but I think it's held by many scientists. It's no longer the end of the worlders who are predicting that possibility. So, John Pfeffer, thanks so much for talking to us. It is really interesting. Tell us how people get to access the Foreign Policy in Focus.
Folks can go to fpif.org. That's Foreign Policy in Focus, fpif.org.
Thanks so much for talking to us today, John.
It was a great pleasure to be on the show.
That was Hugh Masekela with Grazing in the Grass. Next up, Dan Hawken talks with youth organizers about the importance of the Portland climate strike, which includes a climate festival of music and culture as well as a day of striking and a rally. Jan talks with organizers about the demands that will be part of this day of action and the role of music, movement, and art in the climate justice movement. But first, a reminder that we are in our spring membership drive, and you can easily become a member and support this community by donating. KBOO supports local communities of musicians, writers, activists, and artists, and has trained thousands of people through the years by support from our listeners. Please support Community Radio by donating. You can do this in several ways, since we are not in the studio these days. Text kboo.fm/give, or click Donate in the mobile app. You can also text KBOO at 44-321 or mail to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And again, we thank you. This is Sharon Grant for the Omo Variety Hour, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. You can find us on the web at kboo.fm/omvh in capitals, or download the Omo Variety Hour podcast and listen on the go. Now, Jan Hawken talks with young activists about the upcoming Portland climate strike. Jan?
Welcome to KBOO, Roselle Medina, Ella Ray Woodland, Ada Crandall, and Jacob Glass. It's so good to have you with us today.
Hi, Jan. It's good to be here.
This is the fourth year of the student climate strike, that first strike in 2019, bringing out an estimated 4 million people around the world to the streets. So let's start with each of you introducing yourself and saying a little bit about how you became involved in this year's youth climate strike. And then we'll talk about some of the history that you bring to the event as well. Ada, do you want to start?
Sure. Yeah. My name is Ada Crandall. I'm 16 years old. I'm an organizer with Portland Youth Climate Strike and Sunrise PDX. I've been involved in various climate organizing for about 3 years now, specifically focusing on the intersection of transportation and climate. I've been working with the Youth versus ODOT campaign, which is a biweekly series of strikes outside the Department of Transportation headquarters in Portland. And I am really drawn to this strike because it's an opportunity to take the Portland climate movement sort of to the next level and bring together a lot of these different campaigns that have been happening around the city in this really big multi-generational citywide mobilization.
Thank you. Jacob, do you want to say a bit about yourself and what drew you to this day of action?
Sure. I'm Jacob. I use he, him pronouns. I'm 16 years old, and I've been organizing with Portland Youth Climate Strike for 2 years now. A lot of things draw me to this strike, but I think one thing that is really special about it is it's very city focused. I think in past, a lot of these movements are very global, which it makes sense that it is. And I think a lot of the times these strikes are like global events and days of where everyone around the world, all these youth are gathering. But I think this one's really unique because this is a Portland specific strike and festival where it's really about this community and how we can support each other, along with being a part of the global community, but really about the city. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, we'll return to that in a bit. Ella Ray.
Sure. My name is Ella Ray. My pronouns are she, her. I found out about the strike last year. Roselle was helping Ada and Jacob organize another strike that they did in this last fall. And we wanted to continue to support the youth who are making this happen and to also provide an opportunity for people to get connected with all the many climate-related organizations and groups and so many things that are happening right here in Portland and in Portland metro area and beyond. But there's just such a multitude of things that people can plug into to be involved. And Roselle and I have been working together for a few years now, and something that we felt like we kept noticing was a lack of people our age. And so we wanted to kind of bring in the 30s and 40 something folks who might not know where to begin to start to plug in. So we also created this festival to, in partnership with the strike, to provide a place for people to connect with each other and with these groups who are doing all this good work.
So let's return to this multi-generational aspect of your organizing a bit as well. So Roselle, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure, Jan, thank you. So my name is Roselle Medina, and I remember hearing about global warming back before it was rebranded climate change, when I was much closer to Ada and Jacob's age than I am now, and thinking, boy, that sounds like something we ought to do something about. I am a multicultural person of Hopi, Tewa, and Coahuiltecan descent, and I have supported in the past efforts by other multicultural and Indigenous people to fight back against the fossil fuel industry. I've done a lot of organizing in Portland in the early 2000s against the military-industrial complex and organizing critical mass back when that was a big giant thing that happened in Portland all the time. And I've tried to keep my organizing up in various ways during the last 20 or so years. And actually, it was when I heard Ada speak at an event last spring when I was moved to reach out and offer support in organizing. And I'm really honored to be an ally with the youth in this climate movement. And LRA and I last fall got the idea that what we were really feeling called to do was bring some joy and some celebration to the climate movement, and that we wanted to put some effort into that. Not that there was no joy or celebration in the climate movement, but we felt like something that really would light us up around that was doing that. I'm also a lover of music and art, and I knew that there were a lot of artists and musicians who wanted to get involved. So LRA and I thought that it would be a nice addition to the movement to have a way to bring artists and musicians in. And I'm really grateful that Ada and Jacob were open to letting us have this Portland Climate Festival as a companion to the strike that's happening on May 20th.
And of course, all social movements that have been transformative or had a broad impact on history have produced culture and have brought forms of pleasure, challenging old forms of pleasure, commodified ideas of happiness, and brought capacities for joy and forms of desire into the organizing work itself. I think now, with so much of the history of this problem bearing down on us so heavily, I think the space for joy and pleasure can seem less. So how does your group think about that aspect of the problem of the climate emergency that some describe as doomism, that there is a pervasive sense, particularly among young people, that's hopeless, it's too late?
I can speak for myself. I feel like it's easy to get caught up in only playing defense. And I think that's important. And we have a lot that we're up against, but I think we often forget to envision and start practicing the kind of world that we do want to live in, and just, you know, to be able to sustain this movement long term, which it's going to take. We can't fall totally into the doom and gloom, as much as we need to understand the reality of it, but we also need to be able to sustain ourselves and our communities to be able to continue on probably for the rest of our lives.
Yeah, so there's an immediate emergency that mobilizes people, and that's part of the idea of the climate emergency or the climate catastrophe. But there's another aspect of this you're talking about, is sustaining people over the long haul around a different vision of the future and a different vision of a good society. Any of you want to talk as well about the multi-generational aspect of this, that Roselle, you talked about being older, people in their 30s now connecting with K-12 high school and college students? What are the different perspectives on the multi-generational aspect of this struggle?
Yeah, so I think over the years, the term youth climate strike has become sort of a household name. And I think it is important to recognize that young people are leading this movement and bringing urgency to it in a way that past generations haven't. But I also think that it runs the risk of explaining it in a way that makes people think that only young people have a responsibility to fight this fight. And so there are a lot of adults out there who will say, like, oh, the youth climate movement is so inspiring, but then they don't join us. Like, if they're inspired, they should be out in the streets fighting with us. And I really strongly believe that we cannot win the fight to stop climate change if we don't have multi-generational support. Adults need to go farther than calling young people inspiring. We need them to join us. And I think that everyone has a lot to offer to this movement. There are so many different roles, so many different ways for people to get plugged in. And so that's something I'm really excited about the festival, is that it's an opportunity for people to find their role and to build community.
Yeah, and I'd like to speak to that too, if it's okay, Jen. Mm-hmm. I love, of course, what Ada had to say. And I just I want to speak to my fellow Gen Xers. I found out recently that I was diagnosed as being on the waning cusp of Gen X. And it's really interesting. I was talking with a dear friend of mine about Gen X. He pointed out to me that an X is a crossroad. And in a lot of ways, our generation represents a crossroads, both in terms of our humanity's relationship with technology in so many ways. And I think that another way that my generation represents a crossroads is that we were the first generation where pretty much every thinking person understood at that point, when I was around Ada and Jacob's age, that global warming was a real thing. There were still people denying it, as there still are, but we were the first generation where pretty much most thinking people understood that this was a real thing. And while a lot of us have done something about it, we, in my opinion, haven't done enough. And so I feel a real responsibility, and I feel a real sense of responsibility to not only the people who are going to come after me, but the people who are here now, and also to my ancestors, to do more in this struggle. So I want to speak to my fellow Gen Xers. I think, you know, I'm sure a lot of you are doing a lot, and I'm sure a lot of you are doing what you think you can. But I want to just challenge us all to say, like, maybe we could be doing more. You know, organizing this festival has been a real, it's not easy. I didn't realize this, but it's a lot of work to put on a music festival with like almost a dozen performers and 6 hours, and it's free and this and that. But I feel like I'm called to do it. And so I'm answering that calling. And I just kind of want to speak to other people my age and people who are in their 30s and 40s, you know, yeah, maybe there's a chance that like we'll die before this thing gets too horrible, but like, what a horrible way to think. You know, we've got to think about the future of this world, about younger people, and also the people who came before us, who did a lot to ensure us a life on this abundant earth.
This is Jan Hawken talking today with organizers with the Youth Climate Strike happening here in Portland on Friday, May 20th. Well, I think, Roselle, you're also raising an interesting dynamic in this movement around guilt and a certain diffusion of responsibility that I think the fossil fuel industry has promoted, saying, well, you know, we're all in this together. We all equally share in this problem. Are you really limiting enough how many flights you take, or are you recycling enough? And check those light bulbs again. And I think what you're doing in this day of action is also identifying corporations or entities that carry an enormous amount of responsibility for where we're at. The responsibility, you're saying, for all of us everyday people is to come together and confront it. But can you say something about this whole theme of the cast of villains, climate villains for this event? Jacob, tell us a little about that.
Yeah, sure. So this strike, we've kind of been trying to like focus in on a specific issue in the city. And for that, it's for us, we decided it was the climate villains of the city, which are four different entities: Northwest Natural, Zenith, the Portland Business Alliance, and ODOT, as really these different groups that are specifically harming our communities and our planet, and that really need to be called out and that need to be stopped, each in different ways, but all are harming us and all are ignoring the youth and ignoring the future. And we also are calling on our elected officials to stop them, because we all need to work together, because these groups are really damaging our city that is such a great city. But we need to really put an end to the climate villains that are here, and they need to either drastically transform or they just need to stop.
So let's talk about what's happening on Friday and the day's events. There's a wonderful series of activities from angry outrage to peace and love and joy. There's a range of experiences during the course of the day over 6 hours. Ada and Jacob, you want to talk about that first part of the day that you've been organizing?
Yeah, so starting in the morning, students from all across Portland are going to walk out of school. We're also calling on adults to strike from work and join us as well. We'll be meeting at City Hall at 11 a.m., where we will kick things off with a rally and a couple of speakers. We're going to be asking elected officials and candidates to sign a pledge showing their commitment to climate action, because we know that a lot of elected officials like to say that they support the climate movement, but when it's time to actually take action, things fall short. And so we're trying to create some accountability around that and having them really commit to holding the villains accountable and to doing their part. We'll then start marching from City Hall around noon, walking past two of the climate villains, the Northwest Natural and the Portland Business Alliance. We'll chant and sing and do all of the things that the past climate marches have. And then we will end up at Revolution Hall for the festival.
So Ella Ray, do you want to say a little more about the festival part of the day?
Sure. Maybe Roselle and I can both add into this. We've invited, I think we have over 30 organizations coming to table. They'll be engaging folks in the work that they're doing and offering opportunities for people to find their place in the climate movement and connect with each other. Roselle, would you like to talk more about what else we'll be doing?
Yeah, you mentioned sure. Those 12 bands.
Yeah. Well, I didn't count them before I said 12. So if there's fact checkers out there and the number of bands I say and the number that you count don't match up.
But there's a bunch.
You can email me. Yeah, just email me. So yeah, so part of this, like I said, was we wanted to get after the Portland Climate Strike, we've got the Portland Climate Festival at Revolution Hall at 2 p.m. And again, I just want to reiterate what Ada said. We're calling on adults to join us. We know Friday is a work day, but Friday is the day that we're going to be doing a lot of movement building around the climate movement, which is good for everyone and everything. So at 2 o'clock at Revolution Hall outside, bring your jackets, bring your reusable water bottles, bring your blankets. Rebel Wise will be playing with Mike Crenshaw and Quincy Davis. We're partnering with a wonderful organization called Friends of Noise, and they're bringing so much to this festival. A lot of wonderful youth will be performing, Chainsaw Girls, Teeth, Rihanna, Da Boy King, and then also Marissa Anderson, Mostly Wada from Bend is coming up to join us. DJ Acid Wash, our newly reappointed poet laureate, Anis Mojgani, is going to perform. Johnny Franco, The Apricots. So a lot of wonderful artists and then speakers as well. And so that the multi-generational theme of the event is legitimate. We're having, as well as bands of all ages, performers of all ages, speakers of all ages. And again, this is an opportunity, like we're saying, to celebrate the climate that sustains us and the movement to sustain our climate. This is a time to celebrate this movement and to celebrate the climate and to bring people into the movement. This is a day of learning, action, and connection at the festival, as well as at the strike. I'm sure people will be connecting. They'll be acting on behalf of the earth and the natural systems that sustain us and everyone we love. It's free. It's all ages. If you want any more information about it, or if you want to volunteer, you can let us know at portlandclimatefestival@gmail.com.
Be there, be square. I look forward to joining you. And where does the event start? Where do you meet at 11 on the 20th again?
City Hall. Yes.
City Hall, of course. Well, thank you so much, Roselle, Ella Ray, and Ada and Jacob for being with us today on the Old Mole and for your work. And we hope that the community comes out to support you and old people, young people, and the various generations we've been assigned to by a sociologist in between, but we all need to join each other at some point on the barricades around this issue. Thanks so much for all your good work.
You can also follow us on Instagram at Portland Climate Strike.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. Good to know. Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say. It's all right. It's all right. Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say. It's all right. It's all right. Little darling, it feels like years since you've been here. Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say.
That was Nina Sabone with Here Comes the Sun. If you're new to KBOO, here are some things you may not know. We do a lot with the donations you give us. We are volunteer-powered with over 300 volunteers, so please donate to KBOO. It will be money well spent and appreciated. So again, we thank you. Moving on to our last piece for today. Last week, Joe Clement and Emily Drabinski talked about her background as a librarian and union activist, and this week we pick up where they left off, discussing how libraries promote a capitalist view of democracy and economic justice, and why libraries should be champions of democracy in the workplace. Joe?
One way libraries are not neutral is how in every library system in this country, you will find programs and other things offered by the library that teach you how to start a small business, mm-hmm. how to enhance your entrepreneurial skills, how to monetize your hobbies that reflect the interests, ideas, and values of commerce. And the reality is that most of our patrons are working class and are not necessarily looking to leave their jobs. And they have rights as far as what they can do about their work conditions and other things that happen to them at work. And there's a role for libraries to be playing in promoting democracy at work if they are champions of democracy.
Absolutely. Yes. And I think, you know, this idea that most Americans are a coding workshop at the library away from the good life as part of the elite class strikes me as thoroughly cynical and isn't a sort of way of thinking about libraries that I can get behind. But then you're like, well, then why don't we just stop libraries from doing those things? Why can't ALA just strike neutrality out of its code? Like, I hear that a lot. Like, when I was on the campaign trail, people were like, are you going to get rid of neutrality in libraries? And it's like, the understanding of how power works is off there. Like, I am just me, and I'll be in this position for a couple of years. And what am I going to be able to do about that? And there are many other people involved. And, you know, we need a theory of change that includes a rich, deep analysis of power that hopefully we build and make together, right, in order to move the needle on those things. And so, which is why I often say it's not enough to be right. Because if you're right, that's great. Have a good evening. See you in the morning. But if you actually want things to be different, it's a different kind of project. And that's what I'm hoping came through in the campaign, and what I'm hoping can come through in my time on this sort of more or less public stage, that like, do you want that to be different? Here are some ways you can do it. And you know, as well as I do, like, that's like making a list and getting your meetings and making them fun and having food and get everybody's t-shirt size and like choosing a target and building a campaign. And those are the skills. Yeah, I mean, you're right. If we chose to teach those skills rather than how to balance your budget, as if the problem was your math skills and not the maldistribution of wealth, right? Like, how do we make that? I don't know, you know, but we have to make it together.
I want to go back to something you mentioned just about the allocation of resources. And I think that library workers are stepping up in so many ways to meet the needs of especially houseless and other vulnerable populations in our society. And there's this tension that I think is producing a lot of burnout and cynicism among library workers that we're being exploited and that we are expected to just do more and more and more. And libraries should be stepping up to fill those roles, but it shouldn't be falling on us exclusively. It shouldn't be falling on us to make sure that people are housed or that they are getting the emotional care they need because they didn't sleep last night and they're not allowed to sleep at the library. How do you see us starting to kind of pull these apart so that we still have this aspirational institution without falling victim to what library workers have referred to as vocational awe?
Yeah, I think we have to tie any work we do to improve the library as an organization, as a workplace, with a broader sort of political project of expanding the support for other public institutions, right? Because I'm in a library and I just got the job because I care about connecting people to the resources they need to pass their class, right? I'm an academic librarian. So that's what I got in the work to do. But then somebody shows up having been churned through the systems of capital and needs a place to sit and take a nap. And what am I supposed to do in that moment? Like ignore them, quit my job, care for that, right? Like when you think about frontline workers, which is language I, you know, because of its militaristic sort of tone, I don't love, but like the people who are the ones encountering the net effects of massive disinvestment in the social good, of course, we're frustrated and angry, but we need some ways of shifting that from like the problem is the boss, but like I need a better library boss who wouldn't make me do that. Instead, we need like a better government. We need a better and stronger state that invests the sort of systems and institutions that could take care of people. Because what do we have left, really? Like we have crumbling roads and bridges, like everything is sort of falling apart. The attacks on public education, you know, have made it so devastating for people. It's hard to get public support for these kinds of institutions. So what do we have left? We have the library and we have the post office. These are the two institutions that circulate public goods. That's it, right? And so, of course, we're totally overwhelmed and flooded. And so we need to tie that problem we're facing in libraries to the broader sort of social problems that we're all facing. So there has to be a connection. I'm not sure how to make it or how to do activism that crosses both ways. I think lots of people are doing that kind of work. We need more of it. And it's not like anybody has the answer. That's the other thing is people are like, well, what's the answer? What are you going to do? I'm like, I don't know. What are you going to do? What are we going to do? We need like a million things. Because one of the things I learned in the lockout is like, because we won, right? Like, and people will tell you it was a partial win and I could go on and on about that and I won't because it's a union thing and like, whatever. But did they have to bend to us and let us come back to work? They absolutely did. Was it the rally we held? Was it the petition? Was it the letters to the editor? Was it the State Department of Ed? Was it the accrediting body? Like, which of the actions that we took were the ones that pushed the institution to change? And anybody will tell you that the thing that they did was probably the most important, you know, like the truth is we don't know. And so we need as many people doing as many things as possible. But like, how do I get started? And I actually think for a lot of people, it's like, well, what would I do that would make any kind of difference whatsoever in the world that I inhabit and the workplace that I have? And so we need to be producing opportunities for people to do something that has an effect on their world, so that they believe it is possible to make change in the world. The right does this incredibly effectively. I'm totally inspired by the union campaigns at Amazon and at Starbucks. People who are organizing each other and organizing ourselves so that we can do something, which builds our capacity to do the next thing. And I think that's sort of the thing that I would like to see us doing in libraries and in the library association is producing those kinds of opportunities for each other.
And you draw a distinction from Jane McAlevey's work between organizing and mobilizing. Could you expand on that and how you see it maybe informing these efforts in libraries?
Her work is so great and smart and influential for me. And that distinction she makes, organizing is the deeper work we do to build connections with one another and sort of build trust with one another and get to know one another and connect and connect and connect. And if you could see me instead of just hear me, you can see my hands going sort of moving towards each other. That's sort of like, we got to pull everybody together. It's like we got to build with one another. So more and more people in our spreadsheet, more and more people in our contact list. And then mobilizing is when something happens, you activate that organized group, you mobilize them to respond to some urgent thing that's happening. And so we have these fires that pop up all the time in ALA or all the time in libraries. And what if we could just sort of tap an organized group to sort of stand up, I think we would be more effective. Because like we weren't organized when the lockout happened. We had to do that organizing work in response to the crisis. But had we been organized, perhaps we would have forestalled the crisis from ever happening in the first place. But had we been sufficiently organized, we would have spent our time mobilizing in the campaign rather than trying to make sure we had everybody's phone number and t-shirt size, which is like, you should just have that at the ready. Like Joe, I should just know your t-shirt size. We should just know that about each other. Like maybe we need a national library t-shirt size database.
Well, and there's a way business unions have attempted that in a very watered down way where they want to turn the valve on and off for their purposes. But I think that when we talk about organizing with our coworkers, we're also talking about building that agency in a more distributed way. So it's not just a leader calls the shots, but workers decide we have a problem and we need solidarity and we tap these connections.
That's right. Just, I'm not a vanguardist. There isn't anybody who knows the right answer. There's nobody who knows the right way. Like everybody has to be empowered and feel the agency to act on their own behalf and on the behalf of their coworkers and to have solidarity with one another. I think that's exactly right.
So I want to go back to you mentioning how we need to bring everybody together. In libraries, depending on the library system, but in many of them anymore, there's a huge division of labor. And in public libraries, at least, the majority of library workers are not actually librarians. They're library assistants, they're pages, they're clerks. They fulfill these support roles without which the library would just grind to a halt. The librarian, you know, has an important role, but it's not the all-in-one role that it used to be or is in the smallest of libraries. And so, as in lots of industries where you have these divisions of labor, there's classism. There's these divisions that are built for the sake of maintaining power. And I'm wondering, you know, what your perspective on addressing those and bringing everybody into the fold so that they feel like their position in the library system, and it's a system, is valued and important. And it's not just a matter of how do you get out of that and get into the real role.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are upsides to professionalizing in a feminized profession, right? Or feminized field. So the MLS is a degree that allows those of us who have it to make a claim on the boss that we are worthy of more money because of the credential that we have. I think there's tons of value in studying libraries and like it's great to do, but I agree with you that like to the extent that somebody comes in and picks up a book from a shelf and then checks it out and goes home, like the librarian, you know, is one part of the system that makes that possible, but it's the library workers who process the book when it comes in and label it and put the cover on it or whatever and shelve it. And all of those pieces are crucial and should be compensated equally. And so, you know, in my dream future, everybody makes the same amount of money, you know, but like between here, where we are in that future that we, you know, that we can imagine and work towards, we have to reckon with the fact that professionalism is also sort of an engine of the production of workplace inequality. That as the interim chief of the library, I was making five times what some of my colleagues were making, as if my role of like answering email was more crucial. Like that's a part of what the professionalism does, you know, and it's true in every workplace, right? Those kinds of workplace hierarchies. And so I think about, how do we think about who put us in this relationship to one another? Like, how did we end up with this corrosive structural relationship between me and the staff person who makes so much less than me, so that we can understand the enemy as the person who made us this way, right? So I think that's like one thing that I try to think about. Also, I think we're all disposable in the workplace, all of us. And I think sometimes people with sort of who are higher up in the hierarchy can imagine that they're protected by that like I'm so special and fancy and unique and important and expensive that they can't just throw me away. But the truth is that they can and they will when it makes sense for them to do so. And so what's really needed are wall-to-wall unions where everybody in the unit, everybody in the library is part of the unit. And I'm very inspired when I see those campaigns happening, because otherwise you end up with a class of workers that's not governed by the same contract that can be mobilized by management to replace you in the event of any kind of a labor action, right? And so like it benefits capital for us to be split from one another in that way. And so like everybody has to be involved in sort of the organizing campaign in order to make it successful. But I think, you know, you have to address the floor at the same time, right? Like, so we're always fighting in our contract for percentage wage increases. I get a lot more money when that 2% comes in than the people who are making half what I make. So, you know, being mindful of that and making sure that what we're addressing are the concerns of the people suffering the most in our current sort of hierarchies, I think is essential.
Yeah, it's funny how some of the workers in my library, lower paid in the scale workers, like they want a promotion. They see that dignity, mm-hmm. autonomy, pay, compensation, all of the good things only come with promotion. And it's like, you'd like a lot of what you already do. Maybe we should just find a way and make sure that that's compensated, recognized, supported.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, I think the conversation is shifting in ALA around this, like Lessa Pelayo Lozada is the incoming president, and she has as her presidential initiative, or all work has dignity. And I'm like, okay, I can get behind that. And like, that's the thing that if we operationalize as socialists, the only way to give it dignity is to make sure that it is compensated fairly and in a, with a living wage. And like, you know, it's not automatic, right? You have to push for it. So there's going to be room for those conversations.
Saturday morning and the rain is pouring. Dad worked late last night. He's in there snoring. Same old stuff on TV. Boring. So what if I can't go out and play? I know what I'll do today. I'm going down to the library, picking out a book, check it in, check it out. Gonna say hi to the dictionary, picking out a book, check it in, check it out. Now I like books and they like me, so when I go to the library, I sit down in my favorite chair and check to see who's there. Maybe one book, maybe two.
That was The Library Song by Tom Chapin. Be sure to tune in next week for the last installation of the conversation between Joe and Emily on the March 23rd Old Mole Variety Hour here at KBOO 90.7 FM. And that's it for this week's Old Mole Variety Hour. In case you missed it, you can donate to keep this and many shows you have been listening to already today on the air, completely powered by volunteers. How do you donate? Well, you can text kboo.fm/give. You can click donate in the mobile app. You can text KBOO to 44-321. And as always, you can mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. That's it for the Old Mole Variety Hour for May 16th, 2022. Thanks to Mole's Denise Morris for her editing expertise, Bill Resnick and his guest, John Pfeffer, Jan Hawken and her guests, and Joe Clement and Emily Dobrinsky for their piece today. And join us again next week for news, interviews, and reviews from the ground up. That is the Mole's perspective. This is Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for listening.